History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to a special Veterans Day edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to take that initiative to ask the questions and invest the time to listen as memories from way back take on new life in the here and now. Our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. Veterans Day is when we all pause as a nation to honor and remember all who have served. And today we're going to hear memories from sea, air, and land, veterans from three different states who survived harrowing ordeals in three different wars. A small sliver, a snapshot, a sample of what so many millions of Americans have done so the rest of us can enjoy that freedom that America represents. We begin with a centenarian from Idaho. Floyd Thomason was a 17-year-old in the Navy when America was drawn into World War II. He was aboard the cruiser Northampton.
I had no idea that war was imminent. It just didn't keep up with the world news. So it came as a big surprise to me.
And tell me about that. You guys were out to sea with the Enterprise, I believe, when the Japanese showed up, right?
Yeah, that's right. They had loaded a bunch of airplanes on the Enterprise aircraft carrier. They hauled them over to one of the other islands out there. So we were on our way back to Pearl Harbor when the Japanese bombed it. And we were supposed to have been in the harbor at that time. But we got into a heavy storm out at sea on the way back. And then we ran low on fuel for the ship. So during the refueling, one of the sailors threw a big hawser over the side that had broken, and it went down and got tangled in our propellers. That held us up another day. So after all of that, and we got back in on the 8th of December. And that was really a terrible thing to see. All of the ships that had been damaged and laying on their sides and beached on the beaches there, and some of them were sunken completely, and all the airplane hangars and the airplanes were burning, and of course dead bodies floating in the ocean, in the bay there, around through the ships, and it just made you want to cry. You know, here I am 17 years old, and I'm from a farm back in Idaho, and I had never been around that kind of experience, and it really hit me pretty hard. It made your heart beat a little faster.
I can't even imagine how jarring to the senses that must have been. And I don't know if you can answer this or not, but because you described all the factors outside of your control that prevented your ship from being in the harbor that day, have you ever thought about that? What might have happened to you, to your cousin, to other guys aboard your ship if you had been there on December 7th?
I'm sure we would have probably been damaged by the bombs that were dropped by the Japanese on all of the ships that were in the harbor at that time.
And you just told me, you know, looking at that made you want to cry. Were there other emotions that scene, that awareness brought to mind for you?
Well, the other emotions that you have is you wonder what the future holds for you from that point on. You have no idea what's going to happen. They could have put us on other ships or transferred us to a station someplace, a land base. You just never knew what the future was.
And you described so vividly, you know, some of the things that were assaulting your eyes in that harbor that were just so shocking and hard to fathom. What the rest of the country saw, the mainland, after that, a lot of them saw singular images. The Arizona burning, or the Shaw exploding, or maybe just a tattered flag burning in the smoke, and those three words underneath, remember Pearl Harbor. There was a rallying cry throughout the country back here stateside. I'm wondering for you, though, was there some fervor among the troops of, hey, the enemy did this to us, and now we've got to go back and do something to them?
Yes, that was the opinion of most everybody on the ship. So when we get back in shape and condition to where we can travel again out to sea, we're going to go beat the heck out of them and do to them what they did to us here. And that was our objective. Everybody thought the same way about that.
Well, and I know you'd be part of some situations where that took place in 13 different engagements that you participated in the war. But what was the first one? What was the first experience for you in that actual conflict? You saw the aftermath at Pearl Harbor, but then I'm sure you got to experience some of those kinds of things firsthand. What do you remember about that?
It's kind of hard to describe the feeling that you have. We went back out to sea and started bombing and shelling some of the islands that the Japanese had occupied, and it took us quite a while to kind of take over all of that and to get it back under our control again. I think probably the first one that I remember was our journey to Tokyo. We didn't go to Tokyo, but we were escorting ships when Jimmy Doolittle took the bombers to Tokyo and bombed Tokyo, and that was the first engagement. And then the next big one was Midway.
Well, let me ask you about that. All of the raiders, all the pilots and crew members from those B-25s, they've all passed. I do know a nurse who's still living who cared for some of them afterwards, and I've interviewed guys like you who were on either the Hornet or the other ships in that task force. Did you actually see any of those B-25s taken off the deck?
Yes, I watched every one of them take off. Our ship was right next to the Hornet when they were taken off from the Hornet.
And this is something that had never happened before. A bomber had never flown off the deck of a carrier before. So was that a big deal for you guys on your ship? Could people believe it was happening? What was kind of the scuttlebutt or the whispers aboard the Northampton?
We had a pretty good idea of what was happening, and we got the full story of how those bombers became able to take off of that carrier. They stripped them down to where there was hardly anything left but the seats to sit on, because they needed to have all the bombs on them that they could when they went to Tokyo. They practiced for a long time on land, and they got it down to where they only needed 500 feet to take off of. So we were aware of that pretty much. We watched them take off in rough seas, and some of those planes would just almost go into the water. They get so low we thought they were going to, you know, and here we're lifting them up all the time. Come on, lift up, go, get up, you know. And so every one of them managed to get up into the air and form the formations and take off.
Yeah, and of course we know now they had to leave earlier than they planned to because they'd been spotted by the Japanese, and there's so many little parts of that story. But when you think of those men, General Doolittle and all the guys who flew with them that day, the courage it must have taken knowing they couldn't come back, what does that do for you? What kind of feelings do you have about the guys who flew that mission?
Those men that were on that mission, they knew it was a one-way trip because they weren't going to be able to come back to the carrier. So they had to land after they ran out of fuel. It could have been any place where that happened after they bombed the city of Tokyo. And some of them landed in China, but I know that the Japanese managed to capture some of them and they executed them. So that's pretty hard to take, you know.
Yeah, they even executed a huge number of Chinese civilians who helped some of them escape. I mean, that's the horrible side of that story. But the big picture back in the States was, hey, America struck back and hit Japan's biggest city. When did you guys aboard the Northampton find out that that mission had been a success?
It was probably a week later that we got the news.
Did that mean something to you?
Well, it means that we had some pretty brave men doing it.
And for you, on your cruiser, if general quarters sounded, where did you have to go and what did you have to do?
My battle station during battle was a machine gun platform that we had above the foremast on a 50 caliber machine gun.
So the idea is you're firing at enemy planes that might be coming your way?
We had a lot of those. And of course, you never know if you shot it down or somebody else did, because you've got a lot of other machine guns firing at the same airplane.
This may sound like a dumb question, but how much adrenaline is pumping through your system when you're up there on the foremast firing a 50 caliber machine gun at an airplane flying your way at 200 miles an hour or faster?
Yeah, that's pretty exciting when you got a man on either side of you on machine guns that a Japanese Zero fighter is firing at us, and both of those men fall dead, and you're still firing. You can't keep your mind on other things when you're concentrating on an airplane that's coming straight at you and know that he's firing to get you. But I lost two good friends, one on either side of me, by this one airplane, and we finally knocked him out of the sky, though.
Where was that? Which battle was that?
That was in Midway. It's kind of hard to describe everything that went on. You're still in your battle position and firing at an aircraft that's going every which way around there. They're trying to get to the aircraft carriers. So that's all I ever did during battle in the Midway.
It kind of sounds chaotic and I'm guessing exhausting.
Yeah, that lasted for 3 days, you know. You never have any fear. You learn to have no fear whatsoever because you're concentrating on taking out this objective in order to perform the obligation that you have. So my instructor explained that to me one time, that you can't have fear when you're in battle, because if you have fear of your life, then you're going to do something that will cause somebody else to get killed. It just becomes a daily routine. You don't get excited about it at all. We intercepted a Japanese transmission for their surface vessels and aircraft to sink the Hornet and the Northampton at all cost. And that's the way it was worded.
And that was because of the Doolittle raid?
Yes.
You guys were a target because of what you had done to them.
That's the way it seemed to me, yeah. So immediately after we were not able to do any more salvage work on the Hornet, we were ordered to break up a landing party over Guadalcanal at midnight. It was the blackest night I ever seen, and not a star was shining. It was like being in a cave. So when we arrived there, somewhere around midnight, we went into this, what they call the Straits of Tassafaronga. And that's where the Japanese were unloading supplies and ammunition and all the stuff for their troops that they had stationed there on the island. And that's where we got sunk. That was on the 30th of November, 1942.
And I think by now we've learned you've got a pretty clear memory about all these things. So if you're able, can you take us back to the 30th of November, 1942, and walk us through it moment by moment, how you experienced that night that could have ended your life, clearly.
When we entered the Straits of Tassafaronga, of course, we started firing onto the Japanese ships that were in the harbor there, unloading all of their supplies and troops. So Roy and I were stationed on the searchlights of our ship on Northampton. So I can see that just really vividly today, like it happened yesterday. All those Japanese ships on fire and sinking. And we lost several ships in there, too. Roy and I was on the searchlight platform working the searchlights when those two torpedoes hit us. I guess Roy was leaning back against the stanchion there, and when the torpedoes hit, of course, it lifted the ship and it injured his back. When the ship started sinking, we waited until it was over on its side pretty much, and we walked right down the side of the ship into the water. We didn't have to jump off of the ship. There may have been some of them that did. But when I got into the water, I heard somebody hollering for help. And so we had life jackets on, and so I swam over to the person that was needing some help, and it was Roy. He's my cousin. So I managed to get him on a piece of floating debris there, so where he was up out of the water, and I just hung on to it until morning, and we were picked up the next morning at daylight by one of our ships.
I have to ask, were you as calm while that was happening 82 years ago almost as you were just describing it to me now?
I think I was. I was pretty calm. I didn't get very excited about it.
How is that possible? How do you do that?
I don't know how that would happen, but you just get accustomed to it and know what's going to happen. And if it happens, well, I just accept it for what it is, you know.
Well, and that was something else I was going to ask. Had you kind of consciously or subconsciously prepared for that possibility that at some point your ship may get sunk and you may have to do something like that?
Oh, yeah. You're prepared for that all the time. Any emergency that might arise, why, you got to be prepared for it.
So with the ship listing over, the side is now the top, and you basically had a little staircase or a slide right down to the surface, huh?
Yeah, it was a kind of a slide, a pretty steep slide. You could walk on it. It was not too steep, but what you could walk on it, because it's almost laying on its side.
Well, and you said something else there. You stayed in the water all night, got rescued in the morning. It seems to me like there might have been a few things going on overnight, or at least some things going through your mind. What were those hours in the water like, and how long did that feel?
We probably spent 4 hours in the water, but I want to back up here just a little bit. When the torpedoes hit our ship, they exploded right where the engine room and all of our oil supply was, and so it caught on fire, and this fire went right up the main mast, and we had personnel stationed up and down it. Of course, all of those were perished, and you just stood there and watched, and knowing that some of your good friends is burning to death and you can't do anything about it, kind of hits you pretty hard in the heart, you know, and you have a lot of feelings for them. I had one good friend that lost his life there, and him and I made a pact with one another, if either of us should die during the battles and everything that's going on out there before the war ended, that we were to go to the other person's parents and tell them what went on and how it happened, and to assure them that their son had passed away and would not be coming back, you know. And so I did that, and it was a good trip up to Montana.
What was that sailor's name?
His name was Bud Flesher.
And how long after the sinking of the Northampton did you get a chance to go see his family?
It was probably 2 years before I was able to get back up there to see them. I was out of the service at that time. And so my brother and I went up and spent a week with him.
And you've described to us a lot of things that none of us will ever go through. None of us ever have gone through. And we marvel at how you did what you did. But how hard was that compared to everything else you had to do to go to this sailor's parents and talk to them about what happened to their son?
That's pretty tough to have to do that, because his mother kept saying, I know one day he's going to come walking through that door. He's not dead. And I had a terrible time convincing her that he was not going to come home again. She had to accept it that way. And so it's pretty tough to do.
Can't even imagine. And I also can't imagine spending 4 hours in the water, in the dark, with things floating around, enemy in the area. What was going through your mind for that time in the water?
The biggest problem I had was keeping Roy still. He wanted to wave his hand in the air, you know, to come and get me. And I kept telling him, no, don't do that. I said, there's enemy ships here. We don't want one of them to come and get us. Let's wait here till morning. And so I had him up on this piece of debris that was floating there. I think it was a hatch cover. So it had loops of rope around the edges of it, and I just run my arm through one of those loops, and I stayed in the water and kept him comfortable as I could up on top of that until morning. My main objective was to keep us safe from enemies that might have been in the area in another ship that might come up beside us and go ahead and shoot us. But we got through it.
And otherwise, we wouldn't have heard that incredible story. To reflect on this Veterans Day, it's time for our first break. But when we come back, a Vietnam veteran who is the sole survivor of a helicopter crash he'll never forget. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Veterans Day edition featuring vets from three different states and three different wars. Every time helicopter pilot Michael Bush shares his Vietnam story, he also remembers his brother Jimmy, who never got to come home.
Jimmy, as soon as he graduated from high school, chose to go into the Navy as a volunteer. He went into the Navy. He spent a couple of years going from location to location and then was given the opportunity of going to Japan to train in the Jolly Green Giant. He accepted that. When they did throw the blade that crashed and burned, everybody on the helicopter was killed, and they were all unrecognizable. So that was hard to take.
So you've got that as the context. You've got a wife and two kids at home, and you're continuing to fly these dangerous missions. So walk me through what happened the day you got shot down. What was the task, and how were you going about it?
We were flying out of Pleiku in Hueys. We had had an assault mission near Tuiwa that day along the coast where we had dropped off troops to go into combat. Most of the aircraft returned to either Pleiku or Quy Nhon. They assigned two or three Huey units, one of which was mine, to stay in that area overnight in case we had to go in to pick up dead and wounded. When we landed, I was the junior pilot. There was a captain who was the main pilot. I was the other pilot as a first lieutenant. We stopped to get gas, and a young man came to put gas in the helicopter, and he asked me, he said, "Sir, can I sometime get a ride with you?" And I said, "I'll see what I can do for you." That night, shortly after dinner, I was sitting in the movie theater in the base. We'd had an assault mission in near Quang Nai, Vietnam that day. There were aircraft from Pleiku and from Quy Nhon. Mm-hmm. We and one other helicopter crew were left near the landing zone in the local town to provide pickup of dead and wounded if they occurred that night. And sure enough, as soon as it got dark, the Viet Cong and NVA attacked the unit that was on the ground, and we were called to go in and pick up dead and wounded. I had not flown in Vietnam at night at that time, and flying there at night was chaos. It was almost impossible to see what was on the ground. The only thing we could see, the other pilot was older and a captain. I was a first lieutenant. He said, "No problem, I'm used to flying at night." So as we were flying, we started to fly toward the area that where the assault mission had been, and that was near Tuiwa, Vietnam, right on the coast. And it was dark, and in Vietnam at that time, if you flew at night, it was like closing your eyes and flying in a closet. As we approached the area where the troops were, I saw the tracers coming up in front of us, and I said, "Captain, are those people shooting at us?" He said, "Yes, those are tracers." I said, well, I haven't flown at night, and I've never seen tracers coming up at me at night. I guess that's why it surprised me. So we started to do an approach, and as we started to go down, the tracers increased. I suggested to Captain Allred that we do our final approach out over the South China Sea because we wouldn't be taking as much enemy action. He agreed. We started to go out over the South China Sea. As we turned onto our final approach, I heard the ping, ping, ping of the helicopter being hit. Captain Allred said something to me. I turned my head to look at him and say, what did you say? We hit the water and we exploded. The next thing I knew, I was in the cockpit drowning. I quickly hit my quick release button and went straight up, forgetting that I might be in the cockpit. I had either been blown seat and all through the chin bubble, and when I took my seatbelt off, there was nothing between me and air except water, or the roof of the helicopter had been blown off, because I just hit my quick release and went straight up, and there was nothing between me and air but water. When I broke the surface of the water, I was about 5 feet from Captain Allred. He said, did Lieutenant Bush get out? I said, I'm out. He said, are you hurt? And I said, well, I've got some cuts. I can feel the burn from the water. He said, I think I broke my leg. Well, as it turns out, his left leg was broken half, and the left side of his chest had been crushed. The ribs had pierced his lungs. They told me he probably would have died. Well, as he told me that and asked me that question, behind me, one of the crewmen was crying for help. So I turned around and left Allred and started swimming toward the person to help. As I got to the person, he grabbed me and we both went underwater. I fought my way free. We came up to the top and I yelled, don't grab me, I will help you. He grabbed me again. We went underwater again. I fought my way free again. When I popped up, he was gone. I turned around to look for Allred, and Allred was gone. I could not find our crew chief and our gunner. They were nowhere to be found. So I realized by now that I better get out of there. I tried to get my boots off by holding my breath and going underwater and trying to unlace them. And I tried 4 or 5 times to do it. I finally got one boot off. I couldn't get the other one off. Then I realized I didn't know which way to swim toward the shore because it was pitch black. And all of a sudden, the sky started to light up. The Air Force dropping flares looking for us. I noticed as the flares were dropped, I spun around, looked around, and saw off quite a bit in the distance were the mountains. So I knew that was the way I had to go. With the one boot on, I got rid of my flak jacket and my web equipment, which was my .45 and my survival knife. I tried to get as much off me as I could to aid in the ability to swim. I started swimming toward the mountains that I could see from the flares the Air Force were dropping. I would be swimming along, and all of a sudden, a wave would be 10 or 15 feet over my head. It would knock me down and tumble me in the water, and I'd fight my way back to the top. After that happening 2 or 3 times, I realized I could do that to my benefit because just before the wave hit, I would be sucked back a little bit. So as soon as I felt myself being sucked back, I started swimming as hard as I could forward, knowing the wave would tumble me ahead towards the shore. And that worked. As I would go under, I would fight my way back up. I would say, God, please give me one more minute. Then I'd feel myself sliding back, and I'd start swimming as hard as I could, and the wave would knock me forward and spin me upside down. And I did that successfully for quite a while. And eventually, lucky for me, the wave went out and my booted foot was standing on a sandbar. And I panicked. I tried to run and it was no use. As soon as I left the sandbar, there was nothing but water under my feet again. But the waves were so big and high, they were coming 10 feet over my head. They would knock me down. I'd fight my way up and say, God, please give me one more minute. The next wave would come, knock me down and drag me, push me further toward the beach. Eventually, they knocked me down and went out, and I realized I was laying on the beach, face down, thankfully. I think I puked up half the South China Sea. I then thought, okay, after all that went on, I got to get out of here because I know the bad guys are going to be looking for me. They're seeing all the flares dropping. They heard all the helicopters up here. So I went up the beach as far as I could to where it started to go up into the mountains, and I dug myself a shallow grave, and I buried everything except my face. And, of course, I was covered with blood, and the mosquitoes just ate me alive. But fortunately, I stayed like that. And sure enough, in the middle of the night, a group of probably 5 or 6 Viet Cong walked maybe 10 yards away from me, walking down the beach looking for survivors from the crash. And thank God they didn't see me. So I just laid there all night long, knowing that come first light, there would be helicopters everywhere. And sure enough, the next morning, shortly after first light, there must have been 100 helicopters flying in the area. I got out real quick, crawled my way to the street, and got up and was just starting to run toward the helicopter when one of the guys ran and picked me up, took me back, threw me in the helicopter. We went up and we went straight to the 8th Field Hospital in Nha Trang.
Well, and I think everybody who just heard you describe the events of that night are saying he actually went back and flew again. How in the world did he live through that night, first of all? And I've got to ask you, I mean, that has to have been the longest night of your life, right?
Oh, yeah. It was chaos, utter chaos. When I made it out of the helicopter, later the Seabees found the helicopter. It was 3/4 of a mile out in 75 or 85 feet of water. And they said there was nothing left of the helicopter. It had blown up when it hit the water. So I don't know if I was blown through the chin bubble or the roof had been blown off. When I became aware of what was going on, I was sitting strapped in my seat, drowning. I hit the quick release and didn't think of anything. I hit the quick release and went straight up, and there was nothing between me and air except water. So somehow I managed to swim that 3/4 of a mile at night in the middle of the ocean. And that's an area that we had flown over many times during the day, and it was shark-infested waters. And thank God they weren't out that night.
I mean, there's so many elements of this story that say, how in the world did this happen? But just so we understand all the details, somehow, some way, you survived, but everyone else on that helicopter didn't. How many others were aboard?
Four others. They eventually found all four. And what was left of the helicopter, and the CB said, there's no use in trying to salvage anything. It's been totally destroyed.
So
they did eventually find the other four.
Which I'm sure meant the world to their families.
And, oh, yeah.
And those four names are on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall, I would guess.
Yes, they are.
And we'll talk about when you got to go to the wall. But So you get shot down, your helicopter blows up, you come to in the water, get to the surface, somehow swim and have the waves toss you all the way to shore. You're wounded all over your body. You hide yourself in the sand except for your head, getting eaten alive by mosquitoes. Meanwhile, all these wounds that you have, and you have to sit through a whole night not knowing if friendly forces are going to find you or you're going to be captured. And I'm sure you know now some of the prisoner of war stories that have emerged from guys that were captured around that same time. I mean, they were prisoners for 7-8 years in some cases.
I was very, very lucky.
That whole night, what's going through your mind while you're sitting there or you're, you know, holding in that spot?
Fear. Nothing but fear and pain. And I knew if I could live till morning, there would be people, our people, looking for me. And sure enough, first light, there were probably 100 helicopters in the air looking.
And I'm sorry for all these questions, because everybody listening, you know, nobody's been through something like this. So you're the only one that can explain this to us. Are you thinking about your wife and your kids? Are you, Matt?
Absolutely. In the water, we had 2 kids at the time. And in the water, every time the wave would tumble me, I would plead with God and say, please, God, let me live a little longer. I don't want my kids to grow up fatherless. And I would say, please, God, one more minute. And I one more minute myself till I got there.
Maybe there's a one more minute situation you're thinking about in your own life. And maybe Michael Bush's survival story inspires you like it inspires me. It's time for our final break. We've heard from a World War II vet and a Vietnam vet, but what about the Forgotten War? A story you'll be sure to remember when this special edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, honoring all who have served on this Veterans Day 2024. One of the annual opportunities I look forward to is a Veterans Day assembly at Fresno Christian Schools in Fresno, California, where for at least 15 years I've been bringing World War II veterans to share their stories. This year, I got to watch as teenagers imagine themselves in the shoes of a Korean War prisoner of war. 95-year-old Sam Banuelos had them at rapt attention as he recounted the day he was ambushed, wounded in the toe, and captured while serving with the 3rd Infantry Division.
We were going up in a draw, then this fellow, the squad leader, he touched off a grenade, and then right away the enemy started firing at us. You know, we were pinned down, we couldn't fire back. You know, we tried to fire back, but couldn't fire back. And so the squad leader got hit, and he ran all the way downhill, and he passed away that day. And it was so stressful, yes.
How well had you gotten to know those guys?
Not very long, no. No, we had been set in different positions. The commanders moved in different positions, but I didn't really get to know them well, you know, real well, you know. Most of them were, there was a squad that were the Puerto Ricans, so I didn't get to know them very well, though.
And I'm sure there are a few other guys in the room who've experienced something like this, where they are under fire. They know what you're talking about when you say that. But had you experienced that before? Had you had some close calls before that day?
No, that was a fateful day, yes.
So you said four guys from your unit were killed that day, right? And quite a few more wounded?
Two more were wounded. Uh-huh. They took them away. They marched us away, and they took them to another area. That's another camp, I think, yes. Yes.
Was there a moment where you realized you were going to be captured or you had to surrender? How did that unfold?
Well, we were in lying down. One Chinese guy hit me with his rifle right in my head. And he told us, you know, by the sound, told us to move uphill. And then from there on, we started walking, running, until we stopped maybe about 2 hours after that.
How many of you were there that were taken prisoner in that incident?
Okay, let's see, it's six. Mm-hmm. Six of us. Two of the wounded ones, they were separated. They were taken away. Mm-hmm. You know, they were taken away a different way.
So you got smacked on the back of the head with the butt of a Chinese rifle, right?
No, with the rifle itself.
With the barrel of the rifle?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
That can't feel very good.
No, it still feels very bad.
And then, I don't think, has anyone else in the room ever been a prisoner before? So we don't know what that feels like.
There was fear. Yeah. You know, there was apprehension and fear then. You know, because, you know, they didn't know what was going to happen. But then we ran and ran and ran that night. That afternoon, we saw about first. The first stop was about 2 hours after we had been caught.
So you were moving for 2 hours straight before you had a chance to rest.
Yes, yes. And then from there, we were taken to a village. And then from there, the next day, they moved us away to another village. Maybe about 3 or 4 miles or more.
Before that day, had you ever mentally considered the possibility of becoming a prisoner?
No. No. I just, I'm trying to bring it back from what it's like. It was apprehensive. Mm-hmm. There was fear to some degree.
And so they, you know, they had you moving one place to another. How long was it till you finally settled in somewhere?
Well, we stayed in one. We came to a village where we stayed first about a week, and then some more fellows came in. I was two fellows came in. I don't remember the names. There were two fellows came in. I know one of them came from the first, I think from the 1st Cavalry Division.
And how did your captors treat you?
Well, in the beginning of the year, when we were stopped someplace, through the interpreter, because there were some of the Chinese that spoke English, through the interpreter, they used to kind of inform us, you know, what not to do, when not to waste food, and to just keep clean our places where we stay, keep clean, and things like that, you know. But I already had read a little bit about Korea, you know, that it was a backward country, that it wasn't developed. So it was, when you say village, it's a real poor country, you know. The houses were not near any comfortable, just they were like mud huts. So we'd sleep on the floor, you know. And but anyway, it was tolerable.
You said sleeping on the floor, yes. And you also said, you know, you learned not to waste food. So what kind of food did you get? I mean, what did this prisoner diet consist of?
The first days, it was like a peanut, the size of a peanut, and it was kind of a soupy, and there were vegetables, some like a spinach. I think they call it kimchi or something like that. Yeah, it's... We get that, and then as we went along later, they brought something like from cans from that had meat in it. You know, there was different things like that. You know, they were edible. To survive, it had to be edible.
Well, this, I don't know if this is an easy question to answer or not, but I'm just curious. I think it comes to my mind, maybe some others in here. If they had told you
in that first week or two that you're going to have to endure this for 2 years, how would that have made you feel?
Well, I don't know. I'd probably start crying. I don't know. Or, you know, probably worry about it, you know.
And how much did your family know about what happened to you? What was their knowledge?
My family didn't know that I was dead or alive until December, when my brother saw on the television the list that they had released of the prisoners. That's when they found out that I was alive.
So from August to December, your family doesn't know if you're alive or dead. And then your brother, back here in California, is watching television, and they have a list scrolling on the screen of...
I think that's what he has. That's here, that the list of the news. When he was watching the news, they heard the list of the people that had been caught, mm-hmm. you know, had been become prisoners. It was a trying time.
And, you know, most of the Korean War veterans I've spoken to who ended up over there, if they spent a winter there, that was very different from the guys who didn't have to spend a winter there. And you're spending a couple of them as a prisoner. Was that challenging?
Well, yes. And then let's see, in the first winter, we moved in the stages. Every so many weeks, we get moved. By the time we got to the camp, when we were reached, the camp, it was already, the next day it snowed. It was very cold on the way over. On the way over, one of the camps that we stopped, they took 23 of us, put in a small pickup, and 15 of us crammed like sardines. We driven over to this place and to a mining camp. There was a mining camp. Yes, but in the wintertime, when we got there to the camp, to the main camp, camp number one, I think it is. Yeah, it was the next day it snowed. You know, it was real cold on the way over.
Had you ever been in the snow before?
No, I never had been in the snow. My weapon was, they had some buildings, you know, who we were able to, you know, just relax and rest, you know, until they did us to the camp.
And what else did your captors make you do? Did you have work you had to do during the day?
Yes, in the wintertime, when there was heavy snow, we had to clean the snow in the camp, you know, sweep up the snow. We didn't make way for it. We could move around. You know, most of the day, just stay inside a building, just telling stories or reading paper or, you know, really pass the time away that way. Or just talking to the other guys, that's about it. Yeah, but it's a waste of time.
Were there days where you felt yourself losing hope or you wondered if you'd ever get out of there?
I guess there were a few days that probably, not lose hope, just wondered about it. What's going to happen to us and to me, please. Mm-hmm. You know,
I'm also curious where your hope came from. What were the things that kept you going or kept you believing that you could get out of there and come home and see your family again?
I think my I was instilled to have faith in God, you know, and I think that's a trick right there for me, not to lose hope, not to give up, you know, just take it as long as it came along. Whatever we had to do, whatever chore, whatever job, we had to just do it. I know one thing they did try. I don't know, it's well known that they tried to indoctrinate our GIs, you know. But I saw one thing. They didn't succeed, I think, for two reasons. I think the two reasons were that the guys only had two things in their minds. The girls back home and the car. That's all the conversation there was. 99% of the time, I have this car and my car. And then, you know, but the girls also, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's I think it went in one ear out the other when they started talking, because they tried to give take us to some a playground, mm-hmm. and then they start talking about it, and then the guys wouldn't pay attention.
Do you remember how much weight you lost from the time you became a prisoner to the time you got out?
I think I lost about 46 pounds. Yeah, 46 pounds. I was a little thinner than now.
What would you say was the hardest or worst or most challenging thing that you had to deal with?
Over there, I noticed, now I remember, you know, I started becoming more solitary. You know, not anti-social, but just wanted to be kind of like myself. I used to chase a ball almost all day. It was just to pass time away. That was my activity mainly. I'd just go, maybe just go to sleep and then just relax, you know, and think about maybe coming back someday. That was about it. I didn't lose hope, though.
Didn't lose hope, yeah. And eventually, those hopes were fulfilled when You got to taste freedom again. Can you tell us a story of what led up to that and how you experienced that realization of, hey, I have my freedom back?
In the first exchange, it was the first exchange in 53 in April, the second wounded. There was a fellow in that group that told my family, you know, when he came back, he searched my family and he told them that I was a POW. They knew it already, but he said it was all right, you know. He went over and he told them that he was all right. I got sick with pleurisy. I wasn't that in that hospital. It wasn't a modern hospital. It was just a building, like a warehouse, you know, and we made it a hospital. So they took me in, and then the doctor, he punctured my side to get the fluid out of the infection area, you know, and from there I just waited. And when I heard the news about July, you know, that there were going to be an armistice, that raised my whole fire, you know. I thank God. I think we're going to go home. That's what I believe. I'm sure it was my mother's prayers that brought me back.
And now he's 95 and going strong. He'll be riding in the first car of the American Ex-Prisoners of War entry in the Central Valley Veterans Day Parade in the middle of California on November 11th. You can link to the complete original interview with Sam Banuelos and the other veterans you heard from today at hometownheroesradio.com. And make it a point to sincerely thank each and every one of the veterans in your life for their service to our country. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that on Veterans Day and every day, freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.